don't we go ahead and get started? Good morning. This is our third lecture in depth signal processing. What I want to talk about today is I want to introduce the concept of what's really known as linear prediction in a sort of a general formulation. We'll actually introduce this using a formulation that's popular with the depth filtering research area. And then next class, we'll talk in more specifically about how this is applied to modeling of time series. And then that'll pretty much wrap up Chapter 3 in the textbook. So today, we'll cover the basic things. We'll cover the normal equations. We'll show the orthogonality principle, which is a sort of result of the normal equations. We'll then talk about solutions of these equations. We'll talk a little bit about the how you evaluate the quality of the estimate using the error energy. And then we'll conclude by talking about normalized mean square error and why that's a useful concept. I've put some links here. Linear prediction is a topic that actually goes back to the 1940s when people were looking at, it was actually first applied towards economics. People were trying to do time series modeling of stock market information and the like. But it really came to fruition in the 1970s as digital computers sort of became viable and people could do things like matrix inversions and such on computers and do that in real time in a digital signal processing sense. So in the 1970s, there was a lot of work done in this area, and all the basic theory was laid out, and the computationally efficient techniques for doing this were developed. So I've linked here some lectures from our speech recognition class, which has, a fairly nice treatment. Most of this work in the 70s was done in the context of speech processing, both speech coding, speech compression, and speech recognition. Some of it survives today in that the compression algorithm that's used in cell phones, for example, something called code-excited linear prediction, is based on a linear prediction model. And as well as some of this is still used in areas like speech recognition. So I've linked these lectures, which I think give a fairly nice treatment in the context of time series analysis. This book by Markel and Gray, which is out of print, but it's available in the library, this was really a landmark book in the area of linear prediction because it really laid out this whole topic that we're about to discuss based on notions of orthogonality and based on notions of vector spaces. And it's a very thorough treatment of the topic. So for many years, this was the definitive source of this information. There are also a number of speech processing books. This is a fairly standard topic for most texts on speech processing, so I've included one link from a book that has, again, a very detailed work on this. The author of this book, a colleague of mine, Jack Deller, was one of the people who applied linear prediction to try to predict diseases in various medical situations, looking at pathologies. And there was a lot of excitement about this technique that we'll talk about. In the 70s, because they thought you could take images, you could take data, and you could actually apply and do this analysis on that data and detect things like diseases automatically and such. So it actually also energized the whole field of medical diagnostics by computer. And then I also linked a Wikipedia source, which has a lot of good online information. What I'm showing over here, a couple of images related to the lecture today. This is an image of a spectrogram of an audio signal. This is frequency versus time. And what this is actually showing is the spectrogram of the linear prediction model as you compute it on the speech signal. So this is not the FFT-based spectrogram, but this is actually a linear prediction-derived spectrogram. And that's one of the nice things about this representation that we're going to learn about over the next two classes, is that you can use it to actually analyze and synthesize waveforms. When you listen to computer-generated speech on the telephone, for example, it's using a linear prediction model. When you hear that kind of robotic-sounding voice, it allows the voice to be compressed down to very, very low rates. When you see one of these LeapFrog commercials on TV and you watch the kids playing with the games, those games are using a linear prediction model to synthesize voice. And what I'm showing here is a nice shot of one of the ways we use linear prediction. Linear prediction is used as a way to extract features from signals, and it's one of a family of solutions that are employed in areas like speech processing. We can use Fourier transforms, we can use linear prediction, we can use filter banks, and then on top of that, you can do all sorts of follow-on analysis, like you can apply filter banks to linear prediction, you can apply Kepstrel analysis to linear prediction. So you can mix and match these things to get a lot of different approaches to doing feature extraction. And many of these approaches are, most of these are very popular in various fields. In speech processing these days, we use a Kepstrel approach. And in a lot of image processing, we use a Fourier transform-based approach. Let's begin today by defining what we might call the filtering problem. We're going to look at linear prediction today from a filtering point of view. This is also a type of paradigm you might have seen if you've ever taken anything like equalization, blind equalization, those kinds of problems. So we have a signal, x of n, which is applied to a filter, f of n, and that results in a signal, y of n. So this input signal, x of n, is filtered using a linear filter with impulse response, f of n, such that the output, y of n, is as close as possible to some desired signal, d of n. And what we would like to do then is to be able to estimate the parameters of this filter so that we can model this signal. And the difference between these two signals is what we'll call the error signal, and we're going to essentially choose the coefficients of this model by minimizing the error energy. So the performance will be measured in terms of the energy of the error in this kind of scenario. Now this scenario has a number of applications associated with it, but one of the things you might recognize is that if you y of n is essentially what we measure. So for example, y of n could be my voice as recorded through this microphone. What we'd like to get at is this underlying signal x of n. In some applications, we would like to, given measurements y of n, we'd like to infer what x of n was. Now what's an example where that might be useful to you? Sort of a classical communications channel or communications theory type formulation. In the case of something like speech recognition, y of n is the signal that we measure, the audio signal coming through this microphone. X of n might be the actual underlying signal, the words I speak. So you might use this kind of a model to try to go from the signal to the input that generated the signal. In a problem like speech recognition, it could be the words, it could be the excitation signal coming up from your lungs. Where this is more common, though, is actually in a communications setting where y of n might be the signal that you measure at the receiving end. F of n might represent the channel over which the signal was transmitted, telephone lines, satellite links, whatever that might be. And x of n would represent the original signal that you transmitted over the channel. So if you're able to do that kind of a thing, you can actually do what's called blind equalization, which is to convert the signal that you measure back to the signal that was sent. And thereby you can then detect information that's transmitted over a noisy channel. And we'll talk about that application next class in a little more specifics. But that's the kind of problem that we're trying to solve today, is given measurements of the output, we'd like to infer measurements of the input, and we'd like to do that by postulating some kind of linear filter and then estimating the coefficients of that linear filter. Okay. Now, I'm thinking that if you took The DSP class, you should have seen this topic probably in several different classes. One, we used to teach this in a digital signal processing class. I don't know if it's still taught. It's also often part of some of the other entry-level signal processing classes. So the way we're going to estimate the coefficients of this filter is to define an objective function which is based on this error energy, E of n. Let me say one more thing about the communications example. The reason this is relevant to the communications example is the way you decode signals in a communication system is you have knowledge of the signals that were originally transmitted. You know, for example, if you've ever seen it, something like a matched filter or that, you know how the signal was created at the generator. You don't know the specific message, but you know the components of the signal. You know what basis functions were used in that. So you have some knowledge of, if there was no noise, you have some knowledge of what the signal you receive should be. But the problem is the signal that you receive is slightly different than the signal that was sent. It's been corrupted by noise. So we're going to pose this objective function J, and this is going to be based on the energy of the error signal, which we can write as the error signal squared, and then we take the expectation of that. Taking the expectation of that essentially gives us the power of the error signal. We can write this expectation. Expectations are nothing more than sums, so we can write this simply as the sum of E squared of n, which you might also recognize as the power of the error signal. We can also write an expression for the error, then, based on this figure here, we can write that the error, E of n, is equal to the desired signal, D of n, minus the filter convolved with the input. So we're going to restrict our analysis here to the assumption that this is a linear filter, and therefore the output Y of n is just the convolution of that filter with X of n. Now, that linearity assumption, of course, that's a big step. In most real applications, modeling the environment as a linear filter, as a convolution of some signal with a filter, doesn't work. For example, with cell phones, the types of impairments that you observe over cell phone channel are very clearly nonlinear. You have non-stationary noises, you hear noises that come and go regularly. You have fading channels based on the modulation properties of the signal and such. But as you're well aware, in a lot of engineering problems, we begin by making this assumption of linearity, do the analysis, see how far that gets us, and if that doesn't completely solve the problem, then we try to refine the model based on some nonlinear components or such. But today we'll restrict ourselves to this assumption that it's a linear filter. And that's, again, a big assumption, because in a lot of problems that isn't the case. But what it's amazing how far you can go with this kind of analysis. And in fact, linear prediction is used pretty widely because this linearity assumption works pretty well in practice. So if this filter, F of n, that F of n represents the impulse response to that filter. Now, I'm assuming everyone here has some basic exposure to digital signal processing, which typically you'll get an undergraduate signals and systems class, and then perhaps followed by an entry level or a master's level signal processing class. If you hadn't had that, you're probably going to need to do some background reading on that. But we'll introduce most of the topics that we're going to discuss in the class as well. So this filter F of n, we're going to assume, is a constant coefficient difference equation, which means we can write this convolution as a summation of the weights of the filter times delayed samples of the input. Now that this is assuming, of course, that the filter is essentially an FIR filter, which is pretty common in this kind of analysis. Next class will actually show how, even if this is not an FIR filter, we can actually model the filter with this kind of an assumption without no loss of generality. So this isn't as restrictive as it might seem, but for the rest of today at least, we're going to assume this filter is implemented in such a manner. So the goal then is going to be to minimize this error, and the thing that the degree of freedom that we have are the coefficients of this filter. So we adjust the coefficients of the filter to minimize the error. So the way that we do that is we can differentiate J with respect to each coefficient, F of J. I've noticed that with respect to the notes, it seems like the positioning of some of these characters is moving depending on what version of PowerPoint you have. So if you look at, I generate this stuff under Office 2007. So if you look at it with that, hopefully these things will render properly. So we're going to differentiate this function with respect to each coefficient f of j. Now you'll notice here we have f of I because we have a series of coefficients, but this is just a sum, f0, f1, f2, f3, f4, and we can differentiate j with respect to any one of those coefficients. When we do that, of course, the terms associated with all the other coefficients are going to be zero, and we're left with simply the one corresponding to a particular coefficient, which we'll call f of j. So we differentiate j, we take a partial with respect to f of j. Well, that's just going to be the partial of this expectation with respect to f of j. And since that's a quadratic form, the partial of this with respect to f of j is just going to be twice the expectation times the partial of e of n with respect to f of j. This is one of the reasons why we like to use quadratic forms, because they differentiate very, very nicely. So if we then substitute our expression for E of n into this equation, we want to work on this term now. We can write that the partial of E of n with respect to F of j is just going to be the partial of D of n minus the sum of F of I, X of n minus I with respect to F of j. Well, that doesn't look so bad, because differentiating this term with respect to f of j is fairly straightforward. Does this signal d of n depend on the coefficients of that filter? Well, d of n is over here. It's our desired signal. It's in no way dependent on this filter. So the partial of d of n with respect to f of j is just zero. The partial of this summation, now if you're not familiar, if you're not comfortable with doing operations on sums, if you're not sort of comfortable with a lot of DSP, that's okay. Sums, remember, this is just a shorthand notation for just writing the term. So this is just f of 0 times x of n plus f of 1 times x of n minus 1 plus f of 2. So when we differentiate each one of those terms with respect to f of j, the only term that's going to be non-zero is the one associated with f of j. So only one of the terms will remain, f of j times x of n minus j, and when we differentiate that with respect to f of j, we just get x of n minus j, and we have a minus sign here, so we carry that through. So we have minus x of n minus j. So the derivative of the error with respect to f of j is very, very simple. And that's a good thing. So we can then take that result and plug it into our expression for the partial of j with respect to f of j, which we said, just repeating what we had before, this is twice the expectation of e of n times the derivative of e of n with respect to f of j. So for this derivative, we can plug in minus x of n minus j. And for e of n, we can plug in our expression for e of n, which was just the desired signal minus the convolution of the filter with previous values of x. So we now have this product to work with. Well, that's, again, not too bad. The first thing we can do is we can multiply this through and write
d of n times x of n minus j minus this summation times x of n minus j. So, and then we have the expectation of this combined quantity. Now the expectation, one of the reasons expectation operators are nice is because the expectation of a sum is equal to the sum of the expectations. If you have two random variables and you add them together and you want to take the expectation of those, the sum of those random variables, that's just the sum of the expectations. So we can then take this expectation and distribute it amongst the two terms. So we have minus 2 times the expectation of x of n minus j times d of n. That was just the term associated with these two terms. Plus, we have the minus signs here cancel, so we have plus 2 times the expectation of f of I x of n minus I, now times x of n minus j. Yeah, there's a there should be a parenthesis here. Now this term, again, is not so bad. Even though we have x of n minus j times the product times this summation, well, x of n minus j is constant with respect to the sum I. So it's just really a scalar. And therefore, if you have a sum times a constant, you can just move that constant inside the sum. So we're going to move x of n minus j inside the sum, and we have the sum of f of I, x of n minus I, times x of n minus j. And ignore that second parenthesis there. And then we'll just take this term, the minus 2 e of x of n minus j d of n, and put it on the right hand on the right side there. So we have now this derivative is equal to this, and that's looking pretty promising. Why is that looking promising? Well, the sum over I of x of n minus I, x of n minus j, where have you seen that? We talked briefly about that the first class when we did the review of random processes. What kind of a function is this? This expectation, remember, is not with respect to I. This expectation is with respect to n. So we can move the expectation in, and we have the expectation of x of n minus I times x of n minus j. What do we know that as? That's a correlation. That's the correlation of the signal. So we're going to call that R, capital R for the R is autocorrelation, and we have R of n minus I, and we're going to denote that as n minus I, n minus j. That's essentially the lag terms associated with that correlation. And then we'll have that multiplied by f of I. So now we have the sum over I of the autocorrelation times the weight to the filter. And this term we'll just leave as is because that's essentially that's a dot product between the desired signal and the input signal. So we're going to call this term, we're going to call that the function g of n, and since we have x of n minus j, we're going to write that as g of n minus j. G is going to denote the product of x of n and g of n minus j is x of n minus j d of n, the expectation of that. And then over here we have the autocorrelation function. And we wanted to minimize this, and we'd like to actually find the minimum value of this function, which means we want to set this derivative equal to zero. So if we set this equal to zero, we can then move this term over to the right hand side, and we can write what's known as the normal equations, which is that the sum of the autocorrelation of the signal x times f of I is equal to this g of n minus j times d of n. And this is what's known as the normal equation. This gives you a series of equations which we can solve using linear algebra, and we'll show you how to do that in a moment. Now, the reason this results in a set of linear equations really goes back to the fact that we postulated the objective function as a quadratic. So, and you'll see in pattern recognition or signal processing, the use of quadratics is very common because they invariably result in these kinds of linear equations. So the term normal equations arises from, let me go back to that for a second. This is, and another thing to remember about sums is that this is just a shorthand way to write a bunch of terms. So this is actually a family of equations which are represented by this variable I and by the variable j. So this is just a shorthand notation for what's essentially writing a set of linear equations. And in a moment we'll reduce that to a matrix form. So the term normal equations arises from what's the orthogonality of the input signal and the error, and that results from equating derivatives of j to zero. So what we did is we took this term, which was the derivative of j with respect to f of j, and we set that equal to zero. In the process of doing that, we've shown that this expectation of the error signal times x of n minus j is equal to zero. That's essentially what we're left with when we do this derivative. We showed that in the previous slide. So what this says, and this is what's called the orthogonality principle, what this says is that when you use the optimal values of the coefficients, at that point, the error signal becomes orthogonal to the input signal x of n. So you can think about this optimization process as the process of adjusting the filter coefficients until the error signal becomes orthogonal to the input. That's also, you can also think of that as driving the error signal to be white noise. When you reach the point where the error signal is essentially white noise, you've removed all of the information possible out of the signal using this filter f of j. So the filter is often called a whitening filter because it successively, you optimize the coefficients to make the error signal more and more like white noise. And when it becomes white noise, you've essentially reached your optimum point. The orthogonality principle sort of just states that by saying that for the optimal filter, the error is orthogonal to the signal. And it's actually possible to derive this whole process starting with this principle. You could postulate that you want the coefficients to produce this orthogonality condition, and then you can actually derive all the equations from that. So in the original derivations of linear prediction, they actually started with the orthogonality principle, which is a principle that actually comes from statistics. Now, it's also common that we debias or remove the DC value of the input. Carrying the DC having a signal that has a non-zero DC value makes the analysis a little messier because you have to carry this DC value around. So it's very common that we reduce or remove the bias of the signal before we start this operation. So it's very common that when you get your data, the first thing you'll do is subtract the mean from it, estimate and subtract the mean, so that this condition holds. So this implies then that E of n and X of n are uncorrelated. We can also show that when we achieve the optimum filter, the error and the output y of n are also uncorrelated, because the error signal times y of n, well, we can just write that as the error signal times our model for y of n, which is f of I times x of n minus I, the convolution of f and x. We can then move e of n inside the summation because the sum is with respect to I, not with respect to n. And we can also move the expectation inside the summation. So we can write the sum of f of I times the expectation of e of n x of n minus I. And this we've shown is equal to zero, so that therefore the expectation of e of n and y of n is equal to zero when we achieve the optimal filter. So minimum, we can also note that since j is a quadratic function, minimization of that is going to produce a single global max minimum. And one way to verify this would be, so you could actually formally verify this using the second derivative of j, but it's in a textbook they go through a thought argument to demonstrate that this is in fact a minimum. In addition, the minimization of this quadratic form using a linear filter guarantees that linear equations will result, and that's attractive because it produces a computationally efficient solution. We will soon see that such solutions can be derived using basic principles of linear algebra. This was a very, very important result. Linear prediction as a technology had been, some say it actually goes back to the mathematician Gauss many hundreds of years ago, but it was known for quite a while, but it was only in the 70s when they developed these computationally efficient approaches were they able to then implement this on fairly slow speed computers. And in those days we were operating on with computers that were like 1 megahertz, not 1 gigahertz, 1 megahertz. And people were able to actually compute these models in real time on things like audio signals. And that's a result of the fact that we have these linear equations, and we actually have, we'll show next class, some nice recursive solutions for these linear equations. So they can be solved in very, very computationally efficient O of N type computations, if you're familiar with that kind of a notation. Now for, let's talk a little bit about some of the details of these solutions. For stationary signals, we can convert the correlation to a traditional autocorrelation. So what is remember we talked about stationary in the first class. If the statistics of the signal are the same, no matter where you look at it, whether you look at it here, here, or here, we can essentially take this term and write it only as a function of the difference between I and J. If the signal is non-stationary, then it does matter at what point in time N you actually look at this value. But for a stationary signal, we can write this just as a more traditional autocorrelation, which is just a function of the difference between J and I. Similarly, we can also convert this function G. Instead of writing N minus J comma N, we can just write this as a function of J, which is the difference in time between those two arguments. This allows the normal equations to reduce to the sum over I of the autocorrelation times F of I is equal to G of J. So this gives us a set of J equations which have which simply involve the autocorrelation function. And the autocorrelation function, if you recall, is an even function, which means R of minus 1 is equal to R of 1. So this actually just becomes an equation where we have, if you look at, for example, J is equal to 0, we have this sum of R of minus I times F of I. So we have like R of minus 3 times F of 3, R of minus 2 times F of 2, R of 1 times F of 1, and so on. So this becomes a fairly simple set of equations to solve, we can write this actually in matrix form by representing this as a product of a matrix and a vector, and I'll show that in a moment. So the solution to this equation is known as the autocorrelation solution. This equation can be written in matrix form using an autocorrelation matrix. Autocorrelation matrices, if you remember from your random signals course, is a Toeplitz matrix. That simply means that every element in the matrix is a function of its sort of distance from the diagonal. And Toeplitz matrices are very stable, very easy to invert. They have a lot of nice computational properties and nice stability properties. So this is known as the autocorrelation solution to these equations, and it results from assuming that the input is stationary. An alternate form of this solution exists if we use the original normal equation. We can write this as the sum of this term, which instead of using the correlation, this is more in line with the covariance. We have the covariance times the filter coefficient is equal to, again, a covariance-looking term. This is known as the autocovariance solution because the matrix form of this solution involves a covariance matrix. Now, covariance matrices are symmetric, so, and they also have some nice properties, but they're not as simple to process as autocorrelation. So autocorrelation matrices have been the preferred approach to linear prediction for many years because they have the most efficient computational properties. But the covariance solution is actually more in line with what we call the pure least mean squared error solution. So in some instances where people want very high precision solutions, they will use the covariance method. Now, we haven't really talked about how you compute these terms, which are going to require some thought about the summation of the expectations with respect to the time index n. So we now need to consider the limits on these summations. In a traditional frame-based approach to signal processing, we have a finite amount of data with which to estimate these functions. In some implementations, data from previous and future frames are used to better estimate these functions at the boundaries of the analysis window. So let me expand on this thought for a moment. So we're going to come back to that, what I just described about the frame-based analysis in a second, and I want to talk a little bit about that. But before we do that, I want to show you how we can convert this to an actual, using Z-transforms, to something that looks a little bit more like a traditional filtering problem. So if we consider the filter, we haven't really talked about the length of the filter or how we the length of the signal. So let's talk about the length of the filter first. We have, how many coefficients should we allocate to this filter? If the filter, remember we modeled the filter as an FIR filter, finite impulse response. But suppose the underlying structure of the problem is actually an IIR filter. Well, what can you say about modeling the impulse response of an IIR filter? Well, IIR filters have infinite impulse response. So if we allow the filter to be infinite length, and we allow the filter to be non-causal, which means we can go both backwards in time and forward in time, we can write this equation as the sum from minus infinity to infinity of R of J minus I F of I times G of J. And this sum is with respect to I. So this is essentially a convolutional sum. So we can apply a Z transform to this equation, and we can essentially write this this is a convolution, so we can write that as a product of the Z transforms of the autocorrelation function and the Z transform of the filter. And we can write the Z transform of G of J. So we have a nice equation here which says that the autocorrelation times the filter is equal to this G of Z, and therefore the optimal solution for the filter is just the Z transform of G over the Z transform of R. This should be R here. Sorry about that. So if we consider the filter to be infinite length, we can write a very nice expression for the filter in terms of Z transforms. But considering the filter to be infinite length is a problem, because the filter would have an infinite number of coefficients, and you might not have enough data to estimate all those coefficients. So it's very common in practice to allow this filter, to assume that the filter is finite in duration. And to then we can write this convolution here as the sum from I equals 0 to L minus 1 of the R of J, F of J, and set that equal to G of J. So now we have essentially a set of L by L equations, because we have for J from 0 to L minus 1, J represents the filter coefficients. We then have the sums of these L products of the correlation and the signal. So this is essentially gives us an L by L set of equations. And that's why it's easy, fairly easy to write this in terms of matrices. So we can define the filter as a vector of coefficients. We can let this F of I be represented as a vector, which I'll use bold for vectors, bold lowercase for vectors. So we can write that as the vector F. We can similarly write the input data as a vector X. So we can write that the data as a vector X. Now you'll notice the data goes from X of N to X of N minus L plus 1. And the convolution then can be written as a dot product of these two vectors. We can take this convolution operation and we can write this as a dot product of the filter coefficients and the input signal X. And we can write that either as F times X or X times F, just using transposes of either the filter or the signal. So this equation then can be written as an autocorrelation matrix R times a vector F is equal to this vector G. So the gradient of J is just twice R times F minus G, making these substitutions, and we don't then have that the solution to this equation is just the inverse of R times G. So the solution to the normal equations in this case where the filter is finite length is just the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix times this vector G. And that's why linear prediction became a very popular technique. What can we say about the properties of the inverse of an autocorrelation matrix?
When you look at, when you invert a matrix, that's sort of like dividing division, right? And you worry about whether, under what conditions will that inverse exist. Right, and you need the matrix to be non-singular for this inverse to exist. So for the solution to exist, this matrix has to be non-singular. Now, if that was just any matrix, can you guarantee that it will be non-singular? If that R was just any matrix, you know, under what conditions will its inverse exist? What does it mean to be non-singular? How do we analyze a matrix to determine whether its inverse will exist?
Rank of the matrix.
What?
The rank of the matrix.
Okay, and the rank of the matrix is based on one way that we can determine whether an inverse exists is to look at the eigenvalues. If the matrix is considered positive semi-definite, what can we say about its eigenvalues? Okay, so those are some of the basics for this course that you'll need to brush up on. So the reason we're excited, some of us are excited to see this, is because we know that autocorrelation matrices are positive semi-definite. They have really nice properties. Their inverse exists provided the rank is not degenerate, meaning that you can have an overdetermined matrix where the rank is too large, but if the rank is equal to the order of the matrix, its inverse will exist. Not only will its inverse exist, but if you're familiar with the concept of the conditioning factor of a matrix, the matrices are very well conditioned, which means it's fairly easy to compute this even in something like fixed point arithmetic, which was a major issue back in the 70s when signal processors just had fixed point arithmetic. Now it turns out that, and we'll talk about this next class, that this autocorrelation matrix can be inverted without actually doing an inverse using an iterative algorithm known as the Levinson recursion. So the story doesn't end here. This results in a very, very simple way to compute that inverse. But from a linear algebra point of view, this is a very simple equation. You can't get much simpler than that. Now let's come back to so we talked about what happens if the filter is finite. Let's come back to the problem of the correlation function. How do we go about estimating the correlations of the signal, the correlations being this function R? Now these can be estimated in many ways. We talked in the second class about biased and unbiased estimators. We talked about, we actually talked a little bit about ways to estimate the correlation function. But in most filtering type applications, you don't simply have access to the entire signal, right? I mean, maybe in your little MATLAB worlds, you read the signal into a vector, but when you're implementing algorithms in real time and with sort of online processing, you typically analyze the signals in chunks. Okay, and I like to talk about this. You should have seen something like this in your DSP class, but I think this somehow gets lost in this world where we live in MATLAB, where you load the file into memory and you operate on the signal. But in real-time signal processing, what we actually do is we move down the signal in frames. Okay, for an audio application like speech recognition, a frame might be 10 milliseconds. For cell phone type analysis, I think, I don't remember what they use, it might be on the order of 25 milliseconds. But so every 10 or 15 or 25 milliseconds, you're computing a linear prediction model. Now, what data do you have access to that you're going to use to compute that model? Well, if you wanted to use all of the signal, that's a problem because that means you'd have to wait until you had all of the signal, which delay is a very, very bad thing in most real-time systems. So when you talk into your cell phone, the person on the other end is hearing you in real time. There's very little delay because they're not using an infinite amount of signal to compute the coefficients. They're using a small amount of signal. So even though we're computing these coefficients every frame, and a frame could be 10 milliseconds, we also have to ask the question, how much data around that frame are we going to have access to? That's a design parameter. In an audio processing application,
we may do this every 10 milliseconds, but this window may actually is typically about 25 to 30 milliseconds. So that means every 10 milliseconds, we're using, let's say, 25 milliseconds of data, which means only 10 milliseconds of the data is new and 15 milliseconds of the data is old. So what we actually do is, so we have every 10 milliseconds we have the data, but the data that we're using is actually a larger window than that. So then you have to ask the question, how do I want that window oriented? Do I want it centered? Do I want it to the left? Do I want it to the right? Well, recognize the fact that most of us would say, well, I want it centered. If you were programming this in MATLAB, you'd say, well, I want it centered. That seems to be a nice theoretical thing to do. But when you center that window, what happens? Well, you need some of this data here. To use this data here, how does that impact your system? You have to wait for it, which means you're adding delay, right? And in a case of, this might actually cost you a partial part of a frame worth of delay. That's a bad thing. Delay is a very bad thing. Why is delay a bad thing? Well, if you've ever, I currently use an internet link that's over satellite, and it's a pain when you're actually typing, because you type, and then about a quarter of a second later, sometimes the letter shows up. It's really frustrating. I don't know if you've ever talked, if you make an overseas phone call, sometimes you hear this, where there's so much delay that you're talking over each other. Even on cell phones, in fact, you get this problem. Well, that's because these algorithms introduce delay to do all their compressions and all these things. This is where delay begins. If you decide to center your window, you're going to require this amount of delay. You're going to introduce that at the very beginning just to do your analysis. That's not a good thing. So very often, we will actually shift this frame so that it sort of starts in the past and ends here. And you can actually do that without any impact in performance, and that's what's done in most systems, because even though theoretically it might look like this is the right thing to do, practically that's a very bad thing to do. Another thing to think about is, in this kind of a scenario, how much old data do you use versus how much new data do you use? How much data do you share from window to window? When this window is larger than a frame, some of the data that you're using will be shared with the next frame. So every frame, the amount of new data is going to be a fraction of the total data. Now, in most real systems that do this kind of linear prediction, we actually use a lot of overlap. Every 10 milliseconds, we're using 30 milliseconds of data, which means every frame, there's only a fraction of the data, one-third of the data that's new. What does that do to the computation of these parameters as a function of time, if only a small percentage of the data is new every frame? How will that impact the rate at which your parameters vary, or at which they change from frame to frame? If only one-third of this data is new data, can your parameters change very quickly from frame to frame? No. So this is another design parameter. The amount of overlap translates to how quickly you allow your parameters to vary. It's sort of like a low-pass filter. And most systems actually use a lot of overlap, so the parameters change fairly slowly from frame to frame. That's a smoothing type operation. Okay, so let's declare this is our window for this frame, and this is the window of data. That's the X of N that we're going to compute. We're going to use to compute the correlation function. Well, the most popular way to compute the correlation function, not the most rigorous way, but the most popular way, is to just take the sum from n equals 0 to m minus 1 of x of n minus 1 times x of n minus j. Now, this has been studied extensively, and there's actually, if you do the calculation this way, there's a very nice way you can share computations amongst the different correlation terms, and you can actually reduce the number of multiply adds required to compute this. That's called a factored autocorrelation approach. Should have been discussed in your DSP class. We won't discuss it here, but if you want more information on that, I can point you to it. And we've actually got some software that does all these techniques online. But look at this calculation. What happens when n is equal to 0? We need values for x of minus I, right? And I will go from 1 to L. So we need L previous values of x. So if you think about that at n equals 0, those previous values are going to come from this data we retained from the last frame. So even if you declare this to be your window, you have to worry about what the samples that you might need outside the window. If you call this n equals 0, you still need L previous values. So what you can do is take this window and offset into it so that when you back up for those L previous values, you end up at the edge of the frame. Or you could use the previous values from the previous frame by just storing those in memory. This is what we call edge effects. It's always a problem in DSP systems. Book doesn't talk a whole lot about these kind of practical issues, but these are important, and they're very well studied in the book, for example, the Markle and Gray book. Other common forms are to actually here in this form, which is another biased estimator, we add L minus 1 samples so that we, in addition to using the M samples, we also have L samples for the lags. In this formulation, this is one I don't like, but is actually, this is an unbiased estimator. This is where you, depending on the value of the index, you use fewer and fewer data. So the bigger and bigger the lag becomes, the less and less data that you use. And the argument for this is that this allows you to stay essentially within the window and compute the function. But what I don't like about this is that each lag uses a different amount of data. And if the signal is not stationary, which is very common, that's sort of a dangerous thing, especially for large lags. So in audio processing, we've always used this formulation. But in some research type areas, you'll see people sometimes using this. I think MATLAB actually might even use that in its default mode. So correlation matrices are in general well-behaved because they're positive semi-definite, but matrix inversion is computationally costly. Fortunately, highly efficient recursions exist to solve these equations. The covariance matrix can be inverted using something called the Kolesky decomposition. If you're not familiar with that, any symmetric matrix can be decomposed into a product of triangular matrices and things, and then you can do some nice optimization on that. And that kind of thing is discussed extensively in almost any linear algebra book. It's also, you'll see that in most of the textbooks on linear prediction, they'll talk about how to do that. The autocorrelation method can be solved recursively using something called the Levinson recursion, and we'll talk about that next class, because that's a pretty interesting, it's a pretty neat recursion, it's numerically well-behaved, and it actually gives you a lot of insight into what happens to the linear prediction model as you increase the order of the model. So we'll actually go through some of that next class. But next I wanted to talk about the error energy, about what happens to the error as you increase the order of the filter. What you would hope would happen, one of the reasons that linear prediction became very popular
was this idea that you could measure a signal, like my voice, and you could actually estimate underlying properties of the signal from the linear prediction model. For example, one of the key things in speech recognition, if you want to recognize my voice, you would like to know what sounds I'm speaking. And to know what sounds I'm speaking, you'd like to know what position my tongue, my lips, and were in when I was speaking that sound. When linear prediction was first introduced, people had hopes that you could actually use the linear prediction model to learn those types of things from the signal without having to actually photograph your mouth as you're speaking. The hope was that, and then you might ask the question, well, how many coefficients do I need in my model? Well, the hope was that as you increased the order of the model, the error would go down, the model would get better and better, and then at some magic point where the model was the right order, if you went greater than that, the error would increase. So you'd see this nice kind of dip in the error function, and you could declare the right model order as being the minimum of the error. Unfortunately, that's not the way the math works. The math says the bigger the model, the lower the error. The model is always trying to extract information from the signal. The error energy is a measure of the performance of the filter. We can write an expression for the error. We have the error in terms of the power of the we have the objective function in terms of power of the error. We can write that as d of n minus, using our matrix notation now, f transpose times x. We can square this term, so we can write d squared of n plus this term squared minus the cross term, 2 times f times d of n times x of n. Now we can, for this term, if we have this term squared, we can essentially write that as f transpose times the expectation of xn, xn transpose times f. For the cross term, that's d of n times f transpose of x, f transpose times x. For that cross term, we can again move the expectation inside and write 2 times f transpose times the expect... I knew that was going to happen. 2 times the expectation of x times d of n. Now, this energy, this error of d squared of n, we're going to write that as sigma sub d squared. That's just the variance of this desired signal d of n. This term, we can just write, this is just the autocorrelation matrix, so we can write that as f transpose times the autocorrelation times f. And this term we can write as the filter coefficients times f transpose. We can write this f transpose, and that was what we call g, the expectation of x times d. Now the minimum of j we've established is achieved when we set the coefficients f equal to r inverse times g. So we can substitute into this equation r inverse times g, and this equation then reduces to sigma sub d squared minus, and we can write this one of two ways. We can write this as f transpose times r times f, where f here is the optimal coefficients, or we can write this as f transpose times g. But this gives us a lot of insight into how the error behaves. Because we can, well, one of the things you see here is that this is essentially a constant. Sigma sub d squared is the variance of the desired signal. So hopefully as I increase the filter order, this term increases and j decreases. So it seems as though the property of the error is going to be that j will get smaller and smaller as I make this term larger and larger. So we can define an error vector as being the difference of f, the filter coefficients minus the optimal coefficients, and we can derive an expression for the error
that says J is equal to J min plus this V transpose times autocorrelation times V. Now, I skipped the derivation of this because when we go through the Levinson recursion, we'll show this in a much simpler way. But what this is saying is this is relating the error of any filter. You can pick any value of F you want. It's relating that error to the minimum achievable error, which is what happens when you set F equal to the optimal coefficients, plus some term related to the strength of this difference times the autocorrelation. And this expression is important because it shows that the linear prediction filter achieves minimum error, and all other filters, any other values of that filter that you might choose, are going to have an error which is greater than the minimum error by this term. So the minimum error is achieved by F is equal to F star because this term, U transpose R times U, always has to be greater than or equal to zero. And this is a consequence of the fact that the autocorrelation matrix is positive sum indefinite. So this is one way of showing that the linear prediction solution, the least mean squared error solution, does in fact minimize the error. But this also shows us that the error energy is a monotonically non-increasing function of L, the length of the filter, because what becomes apparent here is that as you increase L, this minimum error is just going to go down. And that's an important point because it demonstrates that the accuracy of the model increases as we increase the order of the filter. A longer model will always be better than a shorter model. Now, later we'll see that that's a little bit dangerous because that risks the model overfitting if there's some kind of special noises in your signal and such. And we'll talk about that a little bit next class. Now, the last thing I want to talk about really relates to two important issues. One, which is how do you know when you've got the right model order? And secondly, how do you compare linear prediction on one signal to linear prediction on another signal? You might ask the question, which of two signals is better for linear prediction? You'd like some way of comparing these. But you have a problem in that the scales of these signals may be different. So one of the ways that we can do that kind of comparison is to talk about normalized mean squared error and talk about then the performance of our estimator based on that. So we can define a normalized version of the error by dividing by the variance of the desired signal. So we can define a new error term based on the actual error, which is a function of the variance of the signal. And if we divide by the variance of the desired signal, that in essence normalizes the error. Now the reason this is important is because if you have a signal and you do linear prediction on it, you'll get an error term. Let's call that error one. If I double the amplitude of that signal and I do linear prediction, what will happen to the error signal? All I did was double the amplitude of the signal. It's a linear filter. What's going to happen to the error signal? Double. But the linear prediction, the quality of the linear prediction was the same in either case. Whether the signal has a power of 1 or power of 2 or power of 4, the linear prediction model is the same. It's insensitive to the scale of the signal. That's why the normalized error becomes useful. If we normalize by the variance of the desired signal, we can actually then compare linear prediction models for signals of different power levels. This is the same thing, essentially. Now, what I always find interesting about these things is, so you'll see this in the textbook, but in DSP systems, we actually do this all the time. We normalize the signal before we begin processing it anyway. And it's interesting that there's theoretically a good reason to do that based on what's described here. But that's something that became very obvious to system designers, is you can't let your signals scale very dramatically. So this is the same thing, essentially, as normalizing the input signal to have a power of one before you start processing it. You have to do that when you're dealing with things like fixed point arithmetic. So this is not a new, this is not a completely foreign concept, but if we normalize by the power of the desired signal, then we can write that the minimum error, which was sigma d squared minus f transpose g over sigma d squared, this becomes 1 minus f transpose g over sigma d squared, or 1 minus f transpose r times f. These two are interchangeable. This bounds the normalized error to be between 0 and 1, which is a nice property, because now if we have two completely different signals, we can look at their normalized error and draw some conclusion about how well the linear prediction model is doing. And we can similarly then define a performance measure as 1 minus this normalized error, and that then just becomes this dot product between f and g divided by the error. And this is also bounded, because this is bounded, this is bounded. So this performance measure is a number between 0 and 1 that tells us if it's close to 1, the linear prediction model has done well because the error is minimum at 0. If it's close to 0, the linear prediction model has not done well. So this is a nice bounded performance measure on the quality of your linear prediction. So we have introduced the concept of linear prediction in a very generalized way using an adaptive filtering scenario. Now, next class we'll introduce this in more of a digital signal processing time series type sense. And we'll show a derivation that you may have actually seen in your DSP course, a more familiar derivation, I would say. We derived the equations to estimate the coefficients of the model and to evaluate the error. We talked a little bit about overfitting, but I wanted to add a few comments on that here. Suppose your signal y of n, in addition to being filtered by this filter, suppose y of n also contains some measurement noise. Okay. Which is very common. Any signal we measure always has noise. Suppose that we model that measurement noise as white noise. When we do the linear prediction on the signal, we will get some estimates for f that will include, remember, we're operating now on the filtered signal plus some noise. If the noise is white, what's going to happen when we do the linear prediction? Well, most likely the coefficients will be unaffected because the noise was white, and life goes on. We get a good estimate. So if this is a speech processing example, our estimate of the parameters of the voice signal won't be affected by the measurement noise. And that's a good thing, okay? However, what if the noise is not white? For example, your cell phone. You happen to be talking, your linear prediction analysis is going on fine, but then somebody starts talking in the background, a different person. And the signal you're seeing actually has now two voices on it. Or there's a impulsive noise, a truck drives by as you're talking on your phone in your car. What's going to happen when you do this linear prediction analysis? It's going to take the true signal, my voice, say, plus the noise from the truck, and it's going to model all of that together. Because it doesn't care, it just tries to minimize the error. So the model then starts to include elements of the noise, and that's what we call overfitting. And if you drive your model order up, it's going to suck up more and more properties of the noise. And that's a problem. So with these kinds of techniques, even though we can show the error asymptotically goes to zero, the danger in that is that the model is prone to overfitting. And it'll learn things you don't want it to learn, like properties of the ambient environment, the microphone, the noise in the background, the lighting condition if it's a video application. So we'll talk a little bit more about that next time when we do this time series analysis view of this topic, and it'll become very clear what's happening in terms of the error. Okay, see you on Thursday.